Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am swell.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, an evil, wealthy entity has captured renowned British spy James Bond and is planning to do unspeakably awful things to him. I speak, of course, of Amazon, which has finally decided to throw enough money at Barbara Broccoli and the folks at Eon to wrest creative control of the James Bond franchise from the family and start making all sorts of James Bond TV shows and animated features and probably clothing and stuff. I don't know. Whatever Amazon makes, they can make now with James Bond's face on it. Some background here. Amazon bought MGM, the studio MGM, for around $8.5 billion back in 2021. In addition to acquiring the MGM library, at least the portion that's not owned by Warner Brothers, which was acquired by Turner Entertainment back in 1986 and is now part of the Warner Brothers library. There's all sorts of ins and outs and what have yous here. And rights to characters like RoboCop, Amazon acquired a 49% stake in James Bond, which MGM shared with the Broccoli-operated Eon Productions. Broccoli maintained creative control while sharing costs with MGM, is basically how that deal worked. Over the last 4 years or so, there have been lots of rumblings that Eon wasn't happy with Amazon's plans for the character, that Amazon was getting frustrated with Barbara Broccoli kind of stonewalling everybody. And as a result, it's been impossible for the sock sellers to get the Omega-wearing, Aston Martin-driving super spy into production on a new series of movies or really anything else with the James Bond name attached to it. The deal announced last week seems to take the following shape. Amazon threw a ton of money, around $1 billion, according to Deadline, less than that, but still a lot, according to Matt Bellany over at Puck, to buy basically 2% of the rights to James Bond and take over creative control. My understanding, that's just my understanding, though I will happily be corrected about this by anyone who knows better. And then part of this deal also is that Amazon paid all of that money simply so they could get production rolling again. The financial splits are still the same. Point being here, they didn't buy out Eon and the Broccolis, or, you know, they created some sort of new holding company, whatever. Point is, Broccoli's still going to be getting a lot of money. They just can't say no to stuff anymore, is my understanding of this deal. I find all this fascinating on a business level, you know, the various corporate intrigues, etc. I do find it a little, I don't know, I find it a little sad, frankly, on a creative level, right? This was one of the last franchises and marquee characters that was tightly controlled by a family corporation, you know, like an individual hive mind running it, right? This is not like Marvel or, you know, even with Kevin Feige in charge or DC or anything else, right? I'm not a Bond guy. I never really cared for the Connery Bonds. My two favorite entries in the series are probably GoldenEye and Casino Royale. So I don't have like real strong attachments to the idea of James Bond as a character, but I do respect the idea of James Bond. I respect the way the franchise has kind of protected itself in a world where intellectual property is essentially just another natural resource to be strip mined. Peter, I have a very serious question as we start this off. Which James Bond spinoff show are you most excited for, right? Are you ready for the 24-style real-time breakdown of a day in the life of Moneypenny? Or the new reality show Q Academy, in which Mr. Beast eliminates one James Bond superfan with a YouTube-designed gadget every week?
Oh, obviously I'm a huge Mr. Beast fan, so I want to skip the reality show and go straight to Mr. Beast playing James Bond. He's the right age, right? He's like in his mid-20s. He's, you know, he's got that kind of that camera ready, like the hypey vibe to him. He's modern. He's young, right? This is exactly what the James Bond franchise needs. He appeals to young men in particular, and he has got a giant audience already. And one of the things that we've seen reported in the trades over the past couple of weeks or so is that even to a degree that we hadn't known, casting is being done in Hollywood these days based on social media following. Who has a bigger following on social media than Mr. Beast? Arguably no one. No one. unless you rule out YouTube from social media. So why not cast the biggest social media star, the biggest young male media icon of today as James Bond? I think it's a great idea. How come no one thought of this before? Sonny, you're a genius.
See, this is, and like, we're joking, we're messing around here, but like, I do think that this is a genuine fear. I think people are right to be afraid of this sort of thing actually happening, because it is, we live in a ridiculous world where suits make bad decisions all the time. What was it that Brock Lee said once upon a time? You don't let temporary people make permanent decisions. And that was always the founding ethos of their run on James Bond. And I do think that, I don't know, Amazon's a movie studio like any other movie studio. It is nothing but temporary people. There are no permanent people at a movie studio. So I do think that the odds of bad decisions being made in short order are very high.
Let me just make a defense of this, though. One of the criticisms of the Brock Lee family rule over the Bond franchise is that they didn't allow auteurist, kind of like sort of high-end creators to take a stab at Bond. Christopher Nolan, Quentin Tarantino, folks like that have at least expressed, not like I think, you know, sort of in serious talks kind of ways, but have expressed interest in making Bond films. And that has never been possible under the Brock Lee's rule. And in fact, it's not just that the Brock Lee's have kept folks like Christopher Nolan or Quentin Tarantino away from making Bond movies because those directors would demand total creative control of the kind that they have not given up so far. It's also basically all of the Bond movies, even the ones that I really love. And I think, you know, Casino Royale and Skyfall are really great films, just great. Blockbuster action spy films, great versions of Bond. I think that you can fairly characterize basically the last 40 years of Bond, right? Pretty much the whole franchise, as they're just a trailing indicator of whatever the meta, the kind of prevailing strategy is in Hollywood for making an action blockbuster. And you go back to the 1970s when Star Wars broke onto the scene. What did they make for Bond? Right around that time, they made Moonraker. They made Bond Goes to Space, right? You go to the 1980s, and it's all just kind of like the Bond films all just feel like, they feel like the Lethal Weapon movies, or like, you know, like all the Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer stuff, right? Like, even Skyfall, as much as I love it, is basically just The Dark Knight. It's The Dark Knight, but with Bond. And it's a great movie, and it worked out in that case, largely because of the cinematographer. But like, the Brockleys have always kept Bond in this space of like, let's average out the last few years of successful action blockbusters and then apply that to our property, rather than letting anything new or original or interesting come down the pipeline. And this opens up the opportunity, yes, to exploit the property in other ways, right? You can have Alan Ritchson as, you know, as the American Bond facing off against the British version of, right? Like, you can do all sorts of goofy, dumb stuff. You can frack this property into Marveldom and make it and do too much and lose quality control. But you can also do interesting stuff now in a way that you couldn't before.
Alyssa, I think the big sticking point here, again, the sense I get from reading the media reports, reading around the edges, was not even the film series, though I don't have any special insight here, but I do get the sense that the film series is what it is. But the sense I got was that Amazon really wanted to make TV shows. They really wanted to make TV shows. They really wanted to make James Bond spinoff stuff. And the worry was always, this will dilute the brand. And I don't think that's an unreasonable fear, right? Like, just in looking at what we see in the world of diluted brands, I don't think that's an insane fear.
Wait, you guys didn't love Star Wars Skeleton Key?
Ugh. Skeleton Crew, and I did not watch it.
Obviously, I didn't either.
I think that, part of what makes Bond feel special, and I mean, what I want to back up one second and say, you know, there's the sort of temporary people, permanent decisions, you don't want to do anything to dilute Bond. There are a lot of bad, cheesy-ass Bond movies out there, right? There are a lot of eras of Bond movies that don't work at all. And so it says something that the brand has been rehabilitatable despite you know, castings that didn't work, eras of the movie that were kind of cheesy, you know, despite something like the Flint parodies, which are very funny. I don't know if you guys have watched In Like Flint and Our Man Flint, but they're definitely, like, they're worthwhile sort of 70s era parodies, I think, late 1960s. So, I mean, I think that Bond as a brand is pretty... is pretty resilient, right? And partially it's because Bond is sort of a sub-brand of a larger, very durable brand, which is like the British spy show, right? Or like the British spy genre, you know, and you have the John Le Carré of that all. You have, you know, the sort of riff of it in the form of Slow Horses, which I think, Peter, you and I both really love. Yeah. And so to a certain extent...
I also love it.
Okay. Sorry. I didn't want to...
How dare you?
Are we going to have to fight a duel now? Have I, you know, insulted your name? I'm sorry. So I think that to a certain extent, the idea of sort of a Bond TV show, I totally get why it's appealing, right? I mean, you have a bunch of spy shows that are pretty good. Why not make a James Bond one, right? And... you know, something in the vein of like a James Bond damage control movie, like who are the people who pick up after Bond's exploits, right? Like, you know, is there a sort of Jackson Lamb-like figure who's like, well, he's blown up Rome again. I guess I have to go deal with that now. I do think you could find, like, I think the key would to a successful Bond TV show would be to have it be sort of around Bond, but not Bond himself. Or to do something like, you know, if you riff on something like, it's James Bond an identity that is sort of picked up and retired? Like, do you have, like, all of the old Bonds get together? I don't know. I think there are a lot of ways that this could go wrong.
It'll be just like Spider-Man 3, but James Bond.
There are a million ways that this could go wrong. There are some ways it could go right. But I think being overly precious about the Bond brand is probably unnecessary. It's pretty resilient, which is not to say that a brand can't be screwed up. Like, the cinematic Star Wars brand is really, really screwed up, and I'm not actually sure how you move that forward.
How did they blow it so bad?
I know precisely how they blew it so bad. What they did was they gave too much control to J.J. Abrams. And then Rian Johnson, like that's you, Peter. You talk about, you know, we need to give these, we need to give the this over to a director who can take control of the franchise. And on the one hand, that is appealing to me because I like the idea of a Christopher Nolan sort coming in and doing a Bond trilogy, right, in the style of The Dark Knight. That could be good. But you really do just need to look at Star Wars to see how this goes wrong, right? And, like, the problem with Star Wars, if we really want to relitigate this, is it wasn't just that they gave too much control to creators. It's they gave control to different creators on top of each other. And each of those creators spent the first part of their movie undoing what the last one did. Like, that whole thing was a mess. That there needed to be somebody in charge somewhere who was like, all right, guys, you can't spend 30 minutes in each movie dicking over Kylo Ren's mask.
Right? It's not presidential term.
That's not what we're doing here. We can't do that. The mask exists. Move on, Rian Johnson. There is. I want to take one step back because Alyssa, you mentioned the British spy genre, the resiliency of that, the idea of this, like, you know, kind of like globe-trotting British spy. But there is a very ineffable Britishness. And specifically kind of British Empire-ness to James Bond, that even in the Casino Royale run, the Daniel Craig run of Bonds, is still like kind of the echo in the background of like, what is James Bond in a post-British Empire world? Does he make sense? Does he need to exist? What can he do on his own or with American friends? And I do, the thing I think it's most reasonable to worry about being screwed up is moving the locus of power of the James Bond franchise from England to the Pacific Northwest. Like, unless you have, like, an actual, all I ask is that you put a British person in charge of the franchise. That's it. Any British person.
Christopher Nolan.
Pick a Brit off the, well, he's half American, though. Does he count? I don't know. You pick a Brit off the street. You make him in charge of the franchise and go for it.
Wait, it's got to be a him? So Meghan Markle doesn't count?
Yes, it has to be a him. Could be Prince Harry, and then Meghan Markle could just run it through him. I don't know. Is that a reasonable worry? I think it is.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think James Bond should be British. I enjoy his Britishness, right? And one of the things that's most successful about Skyfall is that it's an argument that even as the Empire is crumbling and there's blowback coming, that James Bond is still really awesome. And the sort of tradition and style in which he came up is worth saving.
Yeah.
So to me, the Britishness is important. But the Britishness ties into something else that has been a subject of discussion around Bond ever since Daniel Craig took over, and also since Craig left the franchise, which is Bond's sense of masculinity and the kind of the particular type of kind of old school, unreconstructed, often, you know, at least teasingly, if not flat out, misogynist masculinity, right? And this, people have different views about exactly like where he falls on this. That we don't need to discuss today. But this has been the big question for Bond casting is, should it even be a man anymore, right? And Broccoli had said it's basically always got to be a man. And it's not clear that like the Amazon folks believe that. And I say that based on some of the reporting that has suggested that some Amazon executives are at least a little bit uncomfortable with the way that Bond has gone about being a sort of icon of like masculine cool while also being kind of an awful person in a bunch of ways. And, you know, I was joking, obviously, about the Mr. Beast stuff, but trying to kind of thread that needle and keep the core fans who are largely male, who expect a certain sort of, who expect certain things out of the franchise, while also, I don't know, dealing with that is like, I think going to be the actual, like the real creative challenge, because there's going to just be some incompatible views out there about what Bond should be and what he should stand for in 2025.
Yeah. And one thing I would say about this is someone who, you know, has written about various aspects of the, you know, should we have a black Bond? Should we, you know, have a female Bond? Is that, you know, there are ways in which some of those switcheroos could be interesting if the movies were sort of about that, right? I mean, what does it mean to, you know, have a female Bond? You know, what does her relationship to that sort of archetype of masculinity look like, right? Like, you could have a butch lady Bond who's kind of interesting. What does it mean for a black man to sort of step into that aspect of Britishness and specifically the British Empire? But in general, you know, as someone who, you know, like, I think thinks diversity in the media is largely a good thing, if not quite as transformative as I perhaps once believed, I would rather sort of see women and people of color have archetypes of their own, if only because that broadens the sort of the number of stories that you can tell about some of these subjects. And the archetype is fun. It, you know, I think I'm all for playing with it, but I don't, you know, I'm a lefty feminist and I don't think James Bond needs to be retired.
But this is also what television can do that you can't necessarily do, or certainly can't do at scale with movies. If you're putting out a feature film franchise built around one character, then that's at most one film every 2 years, and really it's more like one film every 3 to 4 years. If you are making 8 to 10 episodes of television a year or more, then you can experiment with different tones, with different types of characters, with different archetypes. You can place more of these, you can just sort of place more of these people, right? Different types of, you can do different Bond things that might appeal to different audiences and even to smaller audiences. TV shows don't need the mega size, the mass audiences that big budget, you know, $150 to $200 million features need to survive. And so this has not proven to be the case for the most part with kind of these move to TV franchise experiments. I think we've seen what has happened with Disney doing this with Star Wars and with Marvel, where not all of those experiments are failures. You know, I really do like Star Wars Andor, but like this is not kind of proven out. At the same time, it's still a possibility that you can take the smaller stakes, the smaller scale, the like sort of lower cost of entry and the smaller audience size needs of TV, and try to do some interesting stuff with it that the feature franchise, the feature format doesn't allow.
So basically a what if series for James Bond. It sounds awful.
Thank you. Thank you for making that sound awful. As long as the what if is, what if James Bond were Mr. Beast? I think we're okay.
What if James Bond had a TikTok channel?
If it's what if James Bond were Mr. Beast, I will quit this podcast and sail into the West.
Okay, I just, before we finish the segment, I do want to go back to the 1990s real quick here, when Pierce Brosnan was modernizing Bond after like some dormancy, and the reports about, I forget which of the Brosnan Bonds that he was involved in, about like whether or not the Broccoli's were going to allow him to snowboard. It was like, in my head, I am recalling this without looking at the source material or having read it, but in my head, I recall reading like there was like a full year of meetings about whether or not he was going to be allowed to snowboard. And in the end, he ended up like hopping onto somebody else's snowboard after skiing because he's not like a, I forget exactly
that
how it worked
and
out.
And that was the moment the West declined. It was a choice. We made it. All right.
But this was the sort of thing that Broccoli would do, would litigate the hyper particulars of whether Bond was going to be allowed to become just a little bit more modern, like litigate them absolutely to death. And if you're trying to make stuff and make product and get it out the door, you can't do that. You got to just make a choice. Let them snowboard or not.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that James Bond will probably be played by Mr. Beast in the near future? Alyssa?
That specific scenario is a controversy.
Peter?
I am really excited to buy an overpriced James Bond branded bow tie. Finally.
Oh God. All of this is terrible. I've talked myself. At first I was like, this might be all right. But this segment has talked me into really dreading the future, which sounds terrible. Boo future. All right. Sorry we couldn't make an episode happen last week. The President's Day. Stupid presidents. Stop having all of your birthdays on the same day.
Stupid anyway, presidents. That sounds like a segue into our movie.
But we'll have a full on review on the bonus episode this week, because we were gonna talk about the Gorge. We ended up not being able to do it. We're gonna talk about it. Apple is claiming it's the most watched movie that they've ever done in 3 days for new customers coming to the app.
Rom-com annihilation.
Sure. That's basically what it is. It's Overlord Annihilation with a meat cute. It's nice. Who can, you know, that's great. All right. Anyway, on to the main event. Captain America, Brave New World. Let's set the stage here. I want to reset. We're too silly on this podcast so far. We got to get to serious business. This is the first true Marvel Cinematic Universe movie since the end of 2023. It's been almost 18 months. That's when Marvel's bombed at the box office. Just a terrible, disastrous, cratering hole in the ground. And while there have been some Disney Plus shows since, and of course there was an enormous hit in the form of Deadpool and Wolverine, though that's not really an MCU movie. It's kind of an MCU movie. It's not really an MCU movie. It's been 18 months, basically, again, since the last movie in this series. One of the great series, one of the great franchises in the history of the universe. And maybe that's why, in their infinite wisdom, the good folks at Marvel thought it would be a great idea to make Captain America Brave New World a sequel to two of their least loved films. That's what you need to understand about this movie, is that it's not a sequel to any of the Captain America films. It's barely a sequel to the Falcon and the Winter Soldier TV show on Disney Plus, where Sam Wilson was played by Anthony Mackie, and then he became Captain America, and then he was like, "Can I be Captain America as a black man in America?" There was that Barack Hussein Obama guy. I don't know if we're ready for it. We don't know if we're ready for Black Captain America. Anyway, no, this movie is not a sequel to those things, really. It is much more focused on the events and the characters of 2008's The Incredible Hulk. That's right, The Incredible Hulk. General Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross, who was played here in this film by Harrison Ford, who is taking over the role from the recently departed William Hurt, RIP, has been elected president President Ross, and he is trying to close a treaty with India, Japan, and for some reason France, to govern who will get access to the celestial island that appeared at the end of The Eternals. Remember when I said this was a sequel to two of the least loved MCU movies? That's right, The Eternals. The celestial island is back, baby. Seriously, though, this is, again, got to put on my serious face. This is less a Captain America movie than a Thunderbolt Ross movie. Every emotional beat in the film belongs to him. He's trying to prove to his daughter, Betty Ross, that he is worthy of her attention and love. And the only real narrative arc in this film in which he learns to get his anger under control is his as well. The villain in the movie is the Thinkers, played by Tim Blake Nelson. The only reason he exists is because of Ross. He's only mad at the world because of Ross. His desire for revenge is tied directly to Ross. This is a Thunderbolt Ross movie. They should have called this movie Captain America. This is actually a Thunderbolt Ross movie. And look, if you have Harrison Ford in the role, you kind of have to use him, right? Harrison Ford, he's Harrison Ford. But this really does Anthony Mackie no favors whatsoever, not just because Anthony Mackie is no Harrison Ford, but also just because Captain America doesn't have much to do in this movie. He's kind of running around solving a plot that gets largely solved off screen. Again, the movie should have been called Thunderbolt Ross. That's all I'm saying here. It's a direct sequel to The Incredible Hulk that doesn't actually have The Incredible Hulk in it somehow. I don't even... Oh, God. All right. All this even would be fine. All of this nonsense would be fine, I guess, if this movie succeeded as an action film, if it succeeded as the paranoid thriller it is kind of pitching itself as. But it's weak on those fronts, too. It's just weightless green screen battles, CGI man versus CGI jets flying around a CGI island at the midway point. Then it closes with this ridiculous fight between a Red Hulk and a regular human being who is only protected by some vibranium wings. Yes, they're Wakandan. No, I still didn't buy it. Anyway, I don't know. The whole thing is very silly. I did not care for this film. Alyssa, audiences seem to concur with me. The movie has the worst cinema score of any MCU movie, with a B-. That follows the Bs for Eternals, Marvels, Ant-Man and the Wasp, and Quantumania. The film dropped 68% in its second weekend. That's a bad drop. That's the third worst drop of all time for an MCU movie. I don't know. Has this whole thing... I feel like we've been asking for like 4 years if this thing has run out of steam. But you never know. The Fantastic Four could turn it around, right?
Okay, sure. So I have not seen Eternals. I've tried to read the plot summary for that movie like four times and just been like, I don't understand. I'm sorry. And I was so, I mean, I've been pretty busy lately, but I was so zoned out that I forgot that I had a ticket to this movie until 15 minutes, like 20 minutes before it started. And Matt was like, don't you have to be at a movie? So, which tells you a lot about the state of my current enthusiasm for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And this movie did not change my feelings about it at all. I was so bored. And there, like, I don't know. It is not a good thing when I've been sufficiently desensitized that it's like, oh, we're going to destroy the like sweet little island in D.C. where you like to go look at cherry blossoms with your kid. And it's like, eh, I don't care. None of this feels real. These movies are boring. I'm radically desensitized to the stakes in all of them. And this movie also just has a very weird self-important veneer in that part of the plot is about like why it's important for there to be a Captain America, right? I mean, there's literally a sequence where Sam is talking to Bucky Barnes, who's running for Congress for some reason.
Totally. I don't understand.
So it's unclear from this film. And when I went back and read some of the coverage of it, there are some people who say, well, he's not a congressman in this film, but we know he becomes one thanks to some of the preview material for Thunderbolts. And then other people who say that he is a congressman in this film. And I was so zoned out by the time that scene happens, about three quarters of the way through the movie, that I don't remember the specific wording and whether or not he is actually a congressman already or merely running to be a congressman. But we do know that he becomes one over the course of this film and Thunderbolts.
Yeah. And I mean, I want to return to the conversation between Sam and Bucky for a second, but like Americans clearly will vote for a wide range of people for president. But I do think like a 110-year-old brainwashed murderer is like, feels unlikely to me that he would be elected. But hey, we live in, you know, an age of political miracles and wonders, so maybe anything is possible. But yes, yeah, so there's literally this scene where Sam and Bucky are talking about, you know, oh, should Sam have taken the super soldier serum? And Bucky is like, Captain America gave them like something to look up to. You give them something to aspire to. And it's like, you know, the movie is just sitting there being like, this is important for you to watch, right? Like, you will be transformed by watching this movie. And I'm mostly sitting there being like, I don't believe for a second that someone who is not a super soldier would have any chance against like a Hulk. Like, and this is what I'm reduced to watching to these movies, being like, I almost fell asleep during it. I came very close to falling asleep. It's just, there's never anything new. They're always the same. And I'm so bored by them. And, you know, we've had also had sort of a running debate about this podcast about what we should be completist about, right? And like, we're pretty completist when it comes to Steven Soderbergh movies, for example. We've been sort of largely movie completists about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But I cannot imagine watching another 10 years of these things. They're so dull. Like, even something like Kraven the Hunter, which I thought was very dumb and bad, was at times more entertaining than this just because it was so silly. And because it had a Russell Crowe performance.
Just like, because the Russell Crowe shows up and he's large and has accents.
Yes. And like, you know, yes, Sonny, you are correct in that technically there are emotional beats assigned to Thunderbolt Ross, but this is not like a good Harrison Ford performance.
How dare you? You turn yourself into a giant red Hulk and tell me that you're, you know, that's not a good performance. I think that's it's wonderful, the things he can do to his body.
The end of this film does kind of step on our idea for James Bond because Harrison Ford turns into Mr. Beast.
Just stop. I'm tired of you, mister. Enough.
I got to say, listen, there was something you had mentioned in the James Bond segment about the idea of like, well, you know, if you're going to have a movie about a black James Bond or a woman James Bond, then like it has to be kind of about that idea of what it means to be a, you know, a black or female symbol like that. And I got to say, having watched Captain America Brave New World and also having watched Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which is both of these films are obsessed with Sam Wilson being like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know. I like if I'm up to it or, you know, if I can be the symbol America needs. And I'm just like, if you're going to do it well. Don't do it like these two things have done because they have not done them well.
And I think that, you know, it is interesting to me to a certain extent, having watched the first Black Panther movie, to see what Ryan Coogler might have done with this script in particular. Because, like, for example, you know, you have this sort of running thing about Sam not having taken the super soldier serum, right? And about sort of what Isaiah Bradley has lived through. But, like, it would be really interesting to have Sam be like, I do not want to be another black man who's experimented on by the government, right? Like, or, you know, some sort of mistrust of medicine. Like leaning harder into the question of like, okay, if President Ross and I disagree, who's going to make the decisions? Like the sort of questions of power could in like, and I realize that I'm doing the classic dumb critic thing where you're like, if this was an entirely different movie made by entirely different people, maybe it would not have been terrible.
Here's the thing. I have long, complicated thoughts on this. But the show Falcon and the Winter Soldier actually had a good riff on this of where does authority come from? Does authority come from actual physical power? Like, so in that show, there's a character who takes he becomes Captain America. He gets into a fight with superpowered guys, and he realizes that without the super soldier serum, he cannot fight them. Like, he just can't do it. So he takes it, and then it gets into a whole thing. He executes a guy on a live stream. He didn't know it was being live streamed. But, like, it gets into a whole thing. But that's actually a very interesting question about where power and authority comes from. And the show, for at least a couple of episodes, does a good job of looking at it. In this movie, they're just like, well, you know, what's the question? He can absorb punches from Red Hulk.
Right. right.
It's because he's got the wings. He's got the Wakanda wings. It's fine.
Yeah.
Ruth Wakanda forever.
Oh, my God.
Peter, what did you make of Captain America Brave New World?
It's not a very good movie.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs down or thumbs up on... you have more? Okay. I'm sorry.
A little, maybe. That's about it, actually. It's not a very good movie. It's bad on every level, and it's just especially bad in conception. And this is what actually like is the real head scratcher for me. I've seen Marvel screw up scripts and editing and action sequences before. But I don't think I've ever seen a movie where I just can't, a Marvel movie in the modern era, where I just cannot understand why they made this particular movie, why this was the concept that they went with. And it's beyond bizarre. It's actively counterproductive at a moment when Marvel is trying to reset. So you talked about how it's been 18 months since we had a proper Marvel movie. Those of the three Marvel films that came out in 2023, two were big bombs, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, and the Marvels. The third Guardians of the Galaxy film did actually pretty well, but two of them were big problems for Marvel. And there was a sort of widespread recognition, including some comments from top brass at Disney and Marvel, that they needed a reset and that they needed to rethink what they were doing. And their reset here, which is what this is and what it has been billed as, that this is a setup for the next several years of Marvel films, their reset is to go back to some of their least watched, least what liked, most forgotten movies and follow up on the incomprehensible lore from the Edward Norton Hulk film, where Edward Norton has not played Hulk for 17 years because nobody liked that movie. It was considered a misstep, an early misstep at the time, to build a whole action sequence around the Eternals, which was a disaster in so many ways, which was underperformed at the box office, was... at the time, I think at least one of, if not the worst reviewed of the films that Marvel had put out. Also just overlong and boring. And I say this as somebody who likes Chloe Zhao and has liked others of her movies. And to think like this is what the Marvel universe needs to do to draw people back in, I can't figure it out. I can figure out how they ended up with a Chloe Zhao Eternals film that's 2 hours and 40 minutes long. They were looking for small sort of filmmakers with records of making quite small personal movies. And then they wanted to elevate sort of lesser known Marvel properties, hoping for the same kind of success that they got from Guardians of the Galaxy. It didn't work out. I'm not even sure it was necessarily a good idea, but it's cognizable. Like, I can make sense of why they went that direction. Why did they make Captain America 4? And it's not a Captain America movie. It's a sequel to the Incredible Hulk movie that nobody liked and the Eternals film that nobody liked with a bunch of stuff from the TV shows that nobody's watching. Why did they do that? And then you have some additional problems, which is they brought in a director who's... I've only seen one of his previous films, but it's the Cloverfield Paradox is Julius Ona, right? Is one of the handful of films that Julius Ona has made before this. So maybe
one
his other movies are
movies
great.
Ever made.
But the Cloverfield Paradox is awful. It is a movie that showcases how bad Ona is with kind of blockbustery, sci-fi, bigger budget, kind of FX-driven film. Good cast, right? Sure. But like... but it is a movie that showcases a director who has trouble working in this space. So again, we're going to take a terrible idea that is impenetrable to outside, to people who don't care about the deep specifics and the deep lore of the MCU. And then we're going to attach a director who has struggled in this format before. And then we're going to reshoot it three times? I mean, if I understand correctly, all of this stuff with... what's his name?
Giancarlo Esposito.
Giancarlo Esposito wasn't even in the original cut. That was all added after the fact.
Who has not been mentioned once on this show, by the way? That should give you a clue how pointless his whole subplot is to this.
Who's
film.
In like two scenes is like set up, positioned as a major villain, but then doesn't have any kind of major villain payoff. Like his face is on the poster. What is this movie? Who thought, like, what was the thought process that led Marvel to make this movie? It is a movie that doesn't just fail on its own terms. It's a movie that, like, pushes me, that makes me wary of seeing any of these other Marvel movies that are coming out this year, because if this is how they are trying to reintroduce the Marvel Cinematic Universe after some failures and some struggles, then it just suggests that they have their self-conception. Like, they don't understand what the appeal ever was. They've got it all wrong, and it just makes me think, man, Thunderbolts is going to be a disaster.
All right, here, you know what? Exit question here, because we all hated this movie, so it's thumbs down from all of us. I'm not even going to ask that. I want to pose this question. We have not planned for this. I'm throwing a curveball at my co-hosts.
Is that a sports thing?
Right now we're gonna make a decision. Alyssa, should we put a moratorium on doing any more Marvel movies? Alyssa.
Yes.
Peter, should we put a moratorium on doing any more Marvel movies?
Even this movie, which is not performing well at the box office, gigantic second week drop. The first week, it's a $100 million film, and we should be talking about things that more people are seeing rather than things that are fewer people are seeing, while mixing in smaller budget films like the Steven Soderbergh Presence, which not many people saw, but is the kind of thing we want to highlight.
I don't know. I'm very mixed on this because on the one hand, you're right, Peter. It creates a real, more than what people are seeing, creates a real scheduling problem for us when we have to be like, well, what are we going to see? Well, there's only a Marvel movie out, and then that's really all there is for like 2 weeks because everybody gets out of the way, though I think that's changing. On the other hand, there's only so many times we can say these are bad movies that people shouldn't watch. And I'm not sure it's worth everybody's time to keep doing it. I'll abstain for now. Might be the completest run might be over. I don't know. All right. That is it for today's show. I'm going to leave you on that cliffhanger. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we will die. Much like the MCU. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.